Hi guys, and welcome back to another episode of the HYM podcast. It's me and Jake again this week because the BMW superstar can't be here, unfortunately. After that stunning pole lap, which we've all watched back. But yeah, so Jake's back in the UK though. Nice to be home.
Yeah, mate. Honestly, I've been stuck in Germany. It feels like I've been stuck in Germany the whole year so far. I mean, I went away and it felt like winter. It's tipping it down to rain, and now I've come back and it's 25 degrees.
I think this is one of the first times like I've come home as well and actually come back to some good weather.
Yeah. I can't really make the most of it because obviously I'm in isolation, technically. Yeah. So I can't really do anything.
Well, you can sit in the garden.
Yeah, I suppose. I need a tan, actually. I'm looking quite pasty.
Oh, mate, well, if you did what I did at the start of this year and turned into a professional cyclist, you would have been all right.
Yeah. But, well, you were pro Conti level at one point.
Ah, you know. Start with the pros, 100 miles, easy. Yeah. But yeah, who we got on today?
Yeah, we have Red Bull Junior and Formula 2 race winner and championship contender and all-round hero, Jehan Dhruvala. How you doing, mate?
Good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, not bad. Whereabouts are you? I guess you just come back from Baku.
Yeah, I'm right now doing my 5-day isolation at Potter's Bar.
Lovely.
On Friday, so I can get out and enjoy this beautiful English weather.
Lovely. You like to go to Carlin though, aren't you, to like do sim or whatever?
Yeah, Carlin and Red Bull, but obviously we have over a month off.
Yeah.
Feels like a part-time racing driver in this type of a season.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit, obviously, I left F3 after many years last year. so the format or the schedule of the weekends changed obviously a lot since then. Now you have 3 races. We talked about it with a few other guests, obviously. Yeah. How have you found that so far?
Yeah, I think it makes stuff pretty interesting. But honestly, I still think that qualifying is the most important just because I think if you just win the feature race and don't finish any races, sprint races, you can on average win the championship. So it just, I think, shows that the feature race is still very important because, I mean, if you just finish where you start in the sprint races, everyone pretty much averages 12 points apart from the winner. So again, like I said, it's all about trying to qualify as high up as possible. But really, apart from Monaco, I think, as we saw in Baku, as long as you have got some pace in the races, it doesn't really matter where you start. But that's what makes the racing exciting. So I'm not a massive fan of the new format, but I think I'd rather have 12 rounds with 2 races so we drive a bit more. But again, it is the same for everyone. So I guess you just got to make the best of it.
Yeah, I suppose, I don't know if you got more races technically, but it probably doesn't feel that way, does it?
No, I think we got the same, 24 races.
Okay.
But we only have 8 feature races. Last year, obviously, we had 12 feature races. Yeah. So
yeah,
it works out a bit less driving.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, from sort of watching it as, I don't want to call myself a fan, but watching it on TV myself, it seems like there's a bit more conservative driving overall in terms of, especially in the first 2 races anyway.
Yeah, I think the first race for sure, because everyone just wants to finish basically in the top 5 or 6, just because like I said, the points you lose in the first, if you make a stupid error and you lunge someone and crash, then you lose a lot of points. But if you just sit behind them and finish behind them, then you can make those 2 points that you lost back up the next day. So there's a bit of risk for reward. Obviously, if you feel like you're quick and go through safely, then it works out fine. But I mean, in F2 with the carbon brakes, cold tires, everything, the main problems, I think, is just starts in turn 1 and turn 2. So even if people brake early and the brakes aren't in, they just lock up and easily. Endurance.
Yeah, and I guess the tires are still pretty sensitive this year.
Yeah, and they're really hard this year, especially the warm-up. The outlaps and stuff at Baku and Monaco were even 12 to 13 seconds off after a pit stop. So it's literally like ice.
Yeah, and one thing I've not seen before is in Bahrain, where a few guys, I don't know if yourself was one of them, but I think one of the sprint races, was it, or even the feature, I think it was sprint race where Joe used a soft tire or something like that. And it seemed a bit strange to be able to use a soft tire for a whole race distance in Bahrain.
Yeah, I think, honestly, that's Bahrain-specific. I think it's weird to to understand, the soft tire actually is less thermal sensitive than the medium tire. Yeah. So it stays in a better window for longer. And yeah, the medium tire, especially at Bahrain, was super sensitive to thermal deck or the hard tire, whatever. So once you did six laps, you were just going downhill. And I think the race being in the night, you know, gave it even a big advantage to be on the softs. So what happened this year, they've changed the actual compound of the hard tire.
Hmm.
So say last year, the delta from hard to soft was probably half a second. But this year at Bahrain, the delta was almost 1.5 to 2 seconds, just the one lap pace. So the tire itself was a lot quicker, the soft. So that made it possible to use it over a race distance, because say even if you drove around slowly on the softs and saved them, you were still going around the corners quicker than the people on the hard. So
yeah,
that's why even the feature race, the front runners started on the prime tire, because normally you do option prime, but after Joe's stint in Bahrain, the option tire became the prime tire for the feature race.
Yeah. So
everyone threw more laps on that one. So it was just I think it was track specific, because the coming tracks, I think it'll be more normal.
Yeah, I can only imagine how sort of like the casual fan of F2 or racing in general switched on and, you know, knows hard tires, soft tires, the literal meaning of hard tire lasts longer, and seeing people on soft tires. I mean, I didn't know the sort of paddock gossip or from testing or whatever. And even I saw, I was like, well, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
Assuming he was going to do a pit stop. I mean, I remember from the one race I did in F2 in Sochi last year, the first time I'd ever experienced the ultra soft tires. And yeah, I was just fully expecting it to just fall off a cliff after three or four laps. And I remember going to like lap 12, 13 or something like that, and they could have gone longer.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they've changed the compound since the 18-inch rims have come in. Because even last year at Sochi, like you said, we were expecting to have the box on lap 6 or whatever.
Mm.
But the tires just kept going. Even in qualifying, for example, I did my best on the second lap, which is not very normal for these tires. So honestly, like as a team, we have different tires, different rounds. We don't really know how it's going to react. I think that's why it makes F2 very interesting. And you never know who can really be competitive or win.
Yeah, it's something I've experienced over the years in F3, sort of seeing between different seasons, sort of different teams getting on top of things. I think Pirelli do change the tire more than probably people think, or even in the paddock think.
Yeah.
And without obviously we don't have a lot of testing. So if you don't understand it in that testing, you can start the year and you're absolutely screwed almost.
Yeah.
I mean, just as an example, I remember last year in F3, we, from 2019 in H3 to 2020, we were quite confident, and we started the first three races and we were really not nowhere, but we really struggled. And it wasn't until we did the two Silverstone races where we had the same tire compound, where we could do testing effectively in practice for the second weekend, that we learned what the tire needed.
So I think that the thing with these championships is you don't really have much testing at all. So if the car's at a solid base and it works everywhere at an average, then you know, you can see it in F2. Like this weekend, High Tech were very strong. I'm sure you go to Silverstone, there'll be teams who are very strong. But as long as you have the package which is good enough to always qualify and race in the top 5 or 6, then you know, that's what makes you win a championship. So I think as far as a Carlin goes, especially in F2, our package is very competitive over the season.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think unlike F3, now I think there's three competitive teams, I think, in F3 that can fight at the front. But in F2, there's even like 6 or 7 guys who on their day or weekend can win races.
Yeah, it's noticeably more competitive, I think, in F2. Makes, like you say, consistency more key, really. In F3, you need to be winning races more often than not to win the championship. In F2, you just need to score points, I think. Which I'd say so far this year you've done pretty well at. I mean, I guess Monaco was probably the weak range so far.
Monaco basically scored nothing. I scored a point, so I think everyone has had their fair share of results which have not gone their way. But if you see the lineup of the top 9 drivers in the championship, on paper, anyone can win. So, you know, I think it's fair that everyone has been so close, so competitive. Mm. I'm basically one race win away from the championship lead. So it just shows how close everything is. So, you know, after Monaco, I would have signed off to be just 25 points off the leader after Baku. So I can't really have too many complaints. But like you said, it's scoring well when you don't quite have the raw pace, which I didn't really have at Baku. I was, kind of had the pace for top six, but not really for the podium.
Yeah.
Just consistently being up there, getting good starts and scoring points is what makes you win championships.
Yeah, exactly. And you're going to have, with the pace you have and the team you're with, I think you're going to have that one weekend, say like Yuri just had in Baku, where, win two races and it's not going to happen all the time, but have just a weekend like that where you score 30, 35, 40, even 40 points randomly and you're straight away thrown back into it. Or if you're already in it, you've extended it. So you just got to score when you're having a difficult one. But I think people sort of watching this and sort of knowing how F2 has gone this year, I think they would like me to ask about what happened in that one race in Monaco in the last corner.
I think me and Marcus still disagree on it.
Yeah.
Fair to say on that. Actually, he says he didn't do it intentionally, but even a couple of laps earlier, he hit me at the hairpin to come. So I think I was a bit more annoyed about that bit than anything else. So he was trying to hit me at the hairpin so he could stay closer to me when we get to the last chicane. But, I knew Marcus was behind me. So I went into the swimming pool like a maniac, committed a bit too quickly through the right.
Mm.
And I got a woeful exit through the left. So he was all over the back of me. And honestly, I thought I covered the line.
Mm.
And then I kind of lost sight of him. Just with how these mirrors are, and I come into the corner, and the next thing I see is his car on the inside of me, and it felt like he was just dragging me to the wall, to the outside wall. And then I had my steering turned. I was trying to push him into pit entry, but it was just like I was turning right, he was turning left, so we just kind of were going straight, pushing each other, and then obviously he had the inside for the last corner. At the time, very, very annoyed, but it happened. It's racing. I respect him. I think we get along quite well with each other. So at the end of the day, if I was in his place, I would have done the same thing. So,
I mean, I guess in a way, the gap was kind of there, but it was one of them, I think, looking from the outside, that if you continued turning, or if you didn't just effectively give it up, it was a crash.
Yeah.
So it's one of those classic, put you in a case where you either crash or finish. So it was a bit ambitious, but I suppose, like you say, that's kind of racing. But with Baku, obviously, I think you had, just looking at results now, you had fourth, third and seventh, I think. So pretty strong weekend, I think.
Yeah, I think it was a pretty strong weekend. Through practice, I was miles off. I was over a couple of seconds off. But I was doing a bit of a different run just because in Monaco, I felt like I had no time to almost do enough laps. So we decided just to fill the car up and do like a long run and free practice. Just because, anyways, the track changes so much. The compound changes from free practice to quali. So I think that did work out well. Obviously, I qualified in ninth, but I roundabout had the pace where Dan was in the top five. The races, race one, I didn't really have the pace. Like you said earlier, like I just scored, I came fourth. Then in the second race, it was a big step forward. I started seventh. I was very aggressive at all starts and restarts. And I got myself up to the podium spots pretty early on in the race. And after that, again, it was one of the most fun races of my life, just because normally in F2, we have to like save tires and all the lot. But here, it was like a flat out qualifying run from lights to flight, because Yuri was obviously trying to pull away, get out of DRS from P2. And then Beckman ahead of me was also trying to push as much as he could to break DRS. And it was the same for me. I was pushing as much as I could to stay in DRS. So it was pretty much a quali, a lights to flag race. And it's probably one of the most fun races I've had in F2.
Yeah. I mean, I've never driven Baku, but it looks pretty mental, especially in a race situation. Yeah. I suppose pretty lively on things like restarts and sort of, going down into turn one.
Yeah, I think the most, a part which is lively and scary is the lap one, the last two corners. Obviously, it looks easy on TV. But, even in the feature race on a full tank, I did it flat, just knowing that if I lifted a little bit, I would get done down the straight. So everyone is just keeping their foot in and the car's bottoming through the left and then through the right. And it's just not a nice feeling.
No, yeah. I did it on the sim, the F1 sim the other day. And don't get me wrong, it's like so easy, the last corner. But I remember thinking, that's actually a bit tighter than I thought I saw on TV.
Yeah.
So I can anticipate that, yeah, in F2, like you say, at the start of the race, that's pretty much a, like, you know, a rouge kind of nearly level.
Exactly like that. And also the wall, like you said, it's a lot tighter than you think. So as you go around the right, it comes up to your face really quickly.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it's the same for everyone, like you said, like I said earlier. So it was really fun. And, you know, even chatted to the drivers. I chatted to Marcus a bit after the first race because he was behind me always coming out of, say, the last real corner. And I kept asking, how come, like, you didn't have a chance to overtake me? So every time he was within 5 tenths, he had to lift through the last two corners. So that was saving me a bit in that first race. So I was actually, and he said it was one of the worst experiences of his life. He was flat, but he couldn't keep it flat. And, you know, it's just scary going through that, those speeds.
What a wuss. he got pretty lively later on in the race or the weekend, didn't he, with that three wide crash with Dan?
Yeah, yeah.
Have you seen that back?
Yeah, I mean, I witnessed it because I was right behind it. So it was
Of course, yeah.
I got the cutback on, say, all three of
them. He was like, fantastic, great. Until I guess you heard that Teo's done his arm or something like that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, obviously for him, he's done his arm. But
yeah, I suppose that's the advantage of having a gap between races, actually.
Yeah, we have 6 or 7 weeks before Silverstone, but that's the only positive that he can take out of it.
Yeah, I'd also imagine Dan sometimes keeps the limelight off you in a good way, a little bit through the weekend. He's always in the headlines, isn't he?
Yeah. No, he's a really good teammate. Obviously, Dan is Dan. Everyone knows how he is, but, you know, he's super quick, which is the most important. And we have good data. And really, I was his teammate since 2013 in karting. We shared a couple of years together. So, you know, me and Dan get along quite well. We have great respect for each other. So it's quite a good, almost he's like the other end and I'm the other end of the spectrum. So it's a good balance.
Yeah, I mean, Alex will know from when we had him on, he's pretty interesting, isn't he?
Oh,
yeah.
God, he kept us on our feet, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, we're obviously still getting started with this whole project, but he helped our engagement, let's say.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he definitely did. But let's take it back to the start of your career, mate. How did you get into racing, and what was that like first moment that really set you on this path?
Honestly, I started, obviously Jake started very late, but I also started relatively late for racing driver. I started when I was 10. I started Rotax back in India. I did a couple of years there. You know, obviously the competition compared to Europe was massively different. I remember qualifying, no testing. I arrived to my first ever race weekend in a Rotax, like Micromax category. I was 3 seconds off and I qualified fifth. So that's how we can...
No way.
That's how fast the gaps were, you know. So
yeah.
Once you get onto it, I won a lot of races. I won the championship and stuff. And I did a couple of years in India. And then, you know, after that, I moved to Asia. And I really got going after the Force India 1 in a Billion program, where me, Arjun, and Tarun obviously got selected. And we came to England in 2012, and you know, that's really when it started to get serious and things got going.
Yeah, I guess that was the point at which you were like, okay, like, let's give this a go kind of thing as a career.
Yeah, exactly. Just before I actually came to England, you know, I was still very young. I was 13, so that's really when I thought, if I want to take things seriously, you know, that's where I need to go. So I decided to come to England to study and to live, because I was racing in the national championship, the Super One there, and just being around the team doing in karting, like you probably know, you can just do a lot of test days. So you know, that was the plan, to get us ready, to get us fit. And the first ever day I actually did in karting in England, it was PFI and it was hailing, and I pretty much
been there.
pretty much never driven in the rain before. So it was like a huge shock for us, all three of us. And, you know, it really was like, yeah, this is tough. So after that, we kind of got our head down and really knew it's going to be an uphill ladder.
Yeah. But did you have kind of like any inspirations, especially like, let's say, from Indian motorsport that sort of made you want to give it a go?
Obviously, from India, Karthikeyan and Chandak were two Indian drivers. I remember when I was just 10 years old, actually, I'd seen Karthikeyan at an airport, and he was like a celebrity to me at that time, obviously, because he had been in F1 and stuff. Now we share a really strong relationship. Obviously, he's been to F1, done the whole lot. So
yeah,
him and Karun were one of my inspirations. But that really, my main inspiration in F1 at the time was Alonso. Because I was at the age when he was winning the world titles in the Renault in 5 and 6.
Yeah.
And he transitioned to McLaren. So those were the years that I was really interested in watching F1. And ever since, he was my favorite driver pretty much till he left, obviously, a couple of years ago from McLaren.
And he's still here.
Yeah, he's back.
He got a brilliant restart, didn't he?
Yeah.
Back there, yeah.
Yeah, that's phenomenal.
Soft tires.
Now my kind of inspiration is almost the younger guys, you know, who give the run. Like Charles, Lando, Yuki, George, all of these guys, you know, who are really max. Yeah. You know, it's just showing that the guys who come from F2 and F3 can deliver at a high level straight away.
I mean, obviously, I've not driven F1 car, but I can't help but feel like I'm raced in the category, especially F3, obviously, for so many years, that I've seen all these guys at some point been teammates or raced with them and stuff like that. And you sort of, it pushes you, obviously. And I just can't help but think that the level, I don't think people realize the level of F2, F3 and this, you know, we are effectively almost pro racing drivers that aren't getting paid yet.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. The level is very high in F3 and F2. Yeah, like you said, I think obviously we don't get paid, but yeah, I'm sure like if you put the top guys in F3 and F2 in a Formula One car, we would be pretty good.
Right. You've almost seen it in the past few years. Like you say, yeah, with those kind of guys, it's almost everyone that gets into a car seems to, you know, show what we all know anyway.
Yeah.
I've got a question for you both. We saw a couple of years ago, we saw in the bikes, we saw Jack Miller go straight from Moto3 up to MotoGP. And it's not something that's been repeated since, I don't think. No, it hasn't been repeated. Now Jack's obviously factory Ducati driver, rider, with 2 race wins this year already. Do you think that would work in Formula 3 to move straight from Formula 3 up to Formula 1?
Yeah, I think obviously Max Verstappen is probably the only one, his name that comes to light, that he's done it before. But to be fair to the bloke, I think he's a once-in-a-generation talent. It's really hard to imagine doing 1 year of car racing and going to F1 because the amount that I learn and I'm still learning is massive. When you do come to the level of F3, like Jake said, then you feel like you are ready to go to F1. But kind of teams now, with how the license points are, how teams want you, they always want you to progress from F3. To F2 to F1. But to answer your question, do I think it's possible? I think yes. I think people are ready to go from F3 to F1. I think even Daniel Kvyat went from GP3 to F1. So I think it proves that, you know, once you are at a top level and you can drive at the front of the field in F3, which is super competitive, then I think you could be ready to go to F1.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think the perception in F1 is different to MotoGP, where, like JN says, I think the perception is that you have to go to do F2 now, you have to get the super license points, you have to prove yourself again after maybe already proving yourself in F3. George, Charles, trying to think of the most recent ones, even Yuki, I guess, the ones that have done F3, done well, and then gone, you know, not been offered almost the chance to go to F1, they had to do it again. Where I think from looking from the outside, that's not always the case in MotoGP. Like, they're a bit more brave to sort of, you know, stick their neck out and say, well, this guy, we already think he's good enough. Like, we don't need to put him in Moto2.
Yeah.
But I think the level is absolutely good enough. You know, the guy's top of F3 to go into an F1 car and, you know, do the job. But yeah, clearly Max is the advocate of that, and I don't think you'll see it very often. But yeah, I mean, I get we actually had Max on last week, Futural, and he mentioned, just quickly talking about before we move on from karting stuff, that he raced. Oh no, he was in cars, wasn't it? That he raced you, I think, in his first, was it karting or was it
from before?
Karting
in Malaysia, he said.
Yeah, in karting.
Yeah, that's what I didn't. To be honest, I knew he lived in Singapore. I didn't actually realize he started his career out there.
Yeah, he really. I remember him and James Polk. They were like the top guys up there. And Max probably told you as well. The mechanic just pulled me up, and next day told Max, "This guy's your teammate." And we just we rocked up to the track, and all of a sudden, me and Max were teammates, and obviously, for me, he was like a foreigner in Malaysia. So obviously, he was the top guy and our reference pretty much for the first year or so that I started racing.
Yeah, it's funny, it's such a small world, right?
Yeah. Oh, Jake's frozen.
Yeah. Oh, I think from. I'm also a big fan of MotoGP, but I don't exactly know how it works. But they seem like even if you do like 4 or 5 years in Moto2, but then you do well, you get a promotion to MotoGP.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of example from that a few years ago was like Tito Rabat.
Yeah.
Tito did, oh God, he must have had, 4 or 5 seasons at it. Yeah. But then he won. Did he win 2 on the back?
Or was, I think he did. That's Zarco. I think he did.
Cool, 1-2 on the back. And then he went to
So, and then Tito did obviously very well in Moto2 and then got promoted up. But Tito never really seemed to have a fantastic bike in GP. And also, I think from Moto2, we saw that Tito takes a while to adapt to GP or to a category. I mean, he's gone to World Superbikes now, and he's, ex-GP rider. Bautista came in and won his first race. Tito's in 10th, 9th. So.
Are they, and like Formula 2, are they also, obviously, are they professionally paid, or do they still have to pay at a level like Moto 2?
I mean, some of the guys, so in Moto 2, Moto 3, even GP, I think in any form of motorsport now, there's people in all categories paying, and there's people who are getting paid a lot.
Yeah.
Moto 2, Moto 3, I mean, some of the front guys are definitely, they're fully sponsored and earning a living out of their sponsorships.
Yeah.
In Moto 3, there's a couple of guys at the front who I imagine being paid, but then I'd say probably 80, 85% of the field are having to bring big, big money to pay to get their ride. Moto 2 is very much the same. I think there's about 5 to 10 riders who are probably earning a living out of a wage effectively from the team. But then the rest of the field, they're bringing hundreds of thousands of euros.
It seems like there's some like specialists almost in Moto2, Moto3, where the teams can almost, I guess the economics of motorbike racing just is different to car racing, where they can afford to pay some guys that they can know they can get results. I mean, if it was great, I would have been sorted in F3. I would have never left. But yeah, it just seems like there's some guys that maybe have gone. I think Sam Lowes comes to mind. I think he went up to Aprilia, didn't he, MotoGP? Didn't get on with it. And now he's back in Moto2, probably getting paid.
He had a tough old time with that Aprilia. I mean, it wasn't the best bike on the grid. And to step up to the fastest motorbike class in the world and on a bad bike effectively then, it was going to be difficult. But Sam's a ex-world supersport champion, middleweight, sort of 600cc, category specialist now. Another one that springs to mind, Tom Lutie, the Swiss rider.
He was there for ages, wasn't he?
He won a 125 world championship back in like 08, 09 or something like that. And he's still in the middle. He did a year in GP, didn't get any results. He was on a tough bike with Mark VDS, but then he's come back down to Moto2 and he's still very successful.
It'll be interesting, to sort of see in the next decade now with F2 and F3, sort of how it evolves, because, there's almost quite a new fan base, I think, come from Drive to Survive with F1 and obviously the F2 documentary as well. And all you boys in F2, you get quite a big following, you know, for a junior category that I think is kind of, you know, drips down from F1, I think. And these new fans, they watch F1 and then they want to see F2 as well, support races. And I wonder how it will go in the next decade where, you know, there's cost caps coming into F1, or whether it'll be a bit more available for teams, especially to sort of bring sponsorship to the cars, let's say. Like you see Moto2 with like Estrella Galizia comes to mind, and obviously Red Bull's always all quite popular there, and KTM
I mean Red Bull have four bikes in proper Red Bull colours and the Moto3 grid now.
I wouldn't be surprised if you start to see that in F2 in the next decade, where, you know, the almost the return on investment, because the cars are getting, or the championships getting more exposure, it's on TV more, there's more monetization going on, that they almost say to teams, Carlin, High Tech, Prema, oh, we'll sponsor both cars this year.
Yeah. In terms of that, I think that budgets are so big in F2. For example, if Red Bull says, you know, to Carlin, we're going to sponsor both cars, that budget itself is a lot. So drivers, I don't see the drivers getting paid on top of that.
No.
That budget is probably more than some F1 drivers get paid. So, you know, it's a lot of money that already goes into the sport. It's hard for teams like High Tech, Carlin, or anyone to, I think, pay young drivers. So, unlike in Moto2, I don't see Formula 2 drivers getting paid until they get to F1 or obviously go to another category. I think the top guys in F2 are easily good enough to get paid if they choose to go into another form of motorsport.
Yeah, I think that what it might do is, yeah, it won't get paid for sure. Like you say, the budgets are too big compared to motorbikes. But if it brought the budget down by a quarter or a third or something like that, you know, it's not 2 million, it's now one back to 1.2 like it used to be or something like that.
Yeah.
How much more, it still sounds astronomical, doesn't it? But how much more accessible or more availability there will be for drivers to sort of, especially at F3 level, to sort of get onto the support ladder of F1 and show themselves and on TV of Sky and all of this. And I think that'll be quite good for the sport, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Or obviously F1 teams have such a big budget. You know, another thing would be like the FIA make it compulsory to have a 10 million a budget where they need to sponsor young drivers, you know?
Yeah.
Because for them, it's 10 million is obviously a lot of money, but for Formula One teams, at least the top ones, it's not too much.
Yeah.
So if they can identify, at least find some talents that they think who are possible and then bring them, like obviously McLaren have done with Hamilton, with Norris, and, you know, Red Bull are doing with obviously all of us. But if...
You know, maybe even if the teams, you know, with the new cost cap, the cost cap's 175 million, isn't it?
It's less, yeah.
Is it? Well, even if they, you know, if they did 10 million, it's less than 10%.
Well, I mean, there's, I don't know, but I would imagine, obviously, their cost caps come in, so they're spending less. But I would hope that, especially now with Liberty and all these new fans that seems to be happening, especially with the world of social media, that they're able to make more money through marketing and sponsorship. So if they're making more money and also spending less, I don't see why that's a really good idea, I think.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot better return on people's investments now in racing, in all forms of racing. I know, like we said about the cost of F2 there being so high. I mean, compare that to Moto2, Moto3. It's not uncommon in like Moto2, Moto3 tier people bringing about, you know, €500,000 worth of sponsorship. But still, like, that's a lot less than
that's Formula 4 money.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, you're competing in the biggest motorcycle racing championship in the world and you're getting brilliant TV coverage, great social media coverage, and it's half the price of F1 and F2 stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so I can see why Red Bull does put their sponsorship all over those four Moto3 bikes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if there's a way for some money to be put back into the junior categories, Formula 3, Formula 2, to then make it more appealing to the sponsors, it becomes a lot more viable. Everything, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, we just touched on Red Bull. You know, with you, your case being with Force India, or was it even Racing Point, or was it still Force India when you had your last year with them?
Before 2018 was my last season, so I think it was before it was racing one.
Yeah, so you had that pink car, didn't you, in F3? You were F3 with Carlin.
Yeah.
What a car that was, by the way. I need to touch on that.
Oh, the pink one?
Well, not the livery, no, to be honest, no. But the actual this chassis, you know, the championship.
Yeah. It is one of my favorite cars. Like, even now, we have, like, almost 2 months off or 1.5 months off. I feel like I want to drive.
Yeah.
That's one car which you're allowed to drive with the power to weight ratio. So, you know, just to go out, if you can, to a track day or something. Like, I've already asked my driver coach if we can sort it out or something, just because I love driving that car. You know,
it's brilliant, isn't it?
It has. You just.
Should we make a 10-minute segment of every show we do with someone who's drove that car just so they can talk about it again, Jake?
Yeah, because everyone loves it.
Oh, God, it's the same thing every time. Oh, that car.
We had Dan on and he said he preferred it to the Red Bull F1 car, I think.
F1 car, so I can't say.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely can't say as well, but I mean, I preferred, that's my favorite car I've ever driven, for sure. I mean, the best car, well, not best, but the highest power, bigger car I've driven was World Series Renault or F2, but World Series Renault was obviously better than that. But still, I prefer the F3 car, that little F3 car, 500 kilos. You know, that Ram Macchi was just sensational.
Yeah, me. I also drove a couple of days in World Series, and that also felt really, you know, a proper racing car. If that championship carried on, I think it also have been really good.
Yeah, I almost wish the Euro F3 car and the World Series car was the current F3 and F2 car.
Yeah, that would be good. I think the good thing about F2 is the horsepower. It's a lot now that we have. I think it's like 650 or something. It's incredible. Especially every time you go out of the pit lane, especially like street tracks, it feels really, really quick.
I remember going into turn two in Sochi for the first time. Between the walls, it's almost a bit like a tunnel down there, isn't it, with the walls so close?
Yeah.
I was like, whoa, we're getting a bit of a lick on it. I definitely braked a bit early the first time. the current F2 car is just different, isn't it? Like we touched on earlier, 18-inch wheels. I think it's the only championship in the moment with 18-inch wheels. It's just heavy. Obviously, the Pirelli tyres is what the turbo lag as well. It makes the driving style quite different, I think, from the one race I did. I don't know if you find that. Obviously, in your second year, you're probably used to it now, but.
Yeah, I think you just kind of get used to it. I think obviously the car is a lot less nimble than a Formula 3 car. So, you know, it's so much horsepower that you need to try to come out the corners in as much straight line as possible to utilize that power. There's a lot loading up, a lot less lateral loading than you would in a style of driving than you would in Formula 3. So the main thing, like you said, for me now it's just normal. I'm used to it, so it would be cool, like I said, to be able to drive a F3 car again and to see how much different it really is.
Yeah, I mean, at that one race I did, I actually, some people have asked me since, like, what did you think of the F2 car, and I actually said I preferred the FIA F3 car. I don't know what you think to that, but
no, I don't know. I think I prefer F2 for sure because I think Sochi is a bit different, but tracks like Silverstone, Mugello and stuff, when the high speed and the heaviness of the wheel and stuff, you know, then really, like, it feels like a man's sport. You know, if you're not strong enough, you can't turn the wheel. It's literally like, you know, whoever's stronger can get around the corner quicker.
I bet Mugello was pretty hard.
Yeah, very hard. I mean, if the car snapped, there was no point even trying to save it.
I mean, in the F3 car that weekend, I remember I was trying to break DRS the whole race in the lead, and it had to be flat out every lap, and just the whole, we were expecting massive tyre wear, and in the end it became a flat out race, and I was pretty tired after that. I can imagine F2 for an hour was pretty intense.
Yep. For you, because you had that Trident missile behind you down straight.
Oh, we don't talk about that.
those Tridents.
Oh, mate, I said something on the radio that I shouldn't have said, really. So we're not talking about that, Alex. But it was referenced.
He came out the last corner with an 8.5 tenths. He was alongside you before turn one.
Well, you got me started now. So let's
he was
talk
ahead
about
of him.
It.
He was
let's talk about it. I was fuming that whole race. I remember in Spa we were talking every year in Spa. Monza, Trident are quick every single year. I don't know why, but they're always rapid in the straight. I remember the top of our Rouge, we were watching the onboard of Beckman, and he was shifting gear at the top of Radeon, and we were shifting gear like after DRS, like 200 meters later. And I just remember Zendeli being behind that whole race, and we'd see him come out the corner, and you're like, well, he's got me. I've got, you know, there's no choice.
So demoralizing.
Well, I watched the race back, and you know, you had the tower of the intervals, time gaps between cars.
Yeah.
And I would see him, at, like you say, 8 tenths about was, and he would cream past me at the exit of the pit lane. And I would get 8 tenths, and I would be having to overtake around the outside at turn one, you know, coming from behind, and I was fuming.
But I think they obviously know something that helps them go quite quick down the straight. They're even at Monza. At Spa, the sector one is always like ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because even in 2019, after Q1, or the first part of qualifying, I was like 8 tenths off, Trident to 1-2 with PK and Di Francesco. So I was like, all right, run two, I need to get behind Dev. So I got behind him, and he was on his own ahead of me. And I was like a couple of seconds behind him, and he was purple in sector one. And I was only, and I only was a tenth slower than him, but I gained 6 tenths to my previous set in sector one. And then he lost like 6 tenths in the middle sector. So I got a perfect tour for sector three. And he was purple again in third sector. So I managed to get pole.
I don't get what they could do. I mean, we're talking about Prema there as well. And that's like, you know, the seen as the best car out there in theory. And they, you know, Prema wouldn't normally miss a beat. So I can't imagine it's an obvious thing. But like you say, they're always rapid in the straight. It's not like they're that slow in the corners as well. It's not like, for example, in Mugello, I had the same wing level as Zendeli, so it's something else.
Yeah. It's not a wing. Yeah. It's something to do with drag or brakes rubbing or touching or something.
Mm. Yeah. Adaptive suspension.
Yeah.
But let's just quickly touch on that season you had with Prema. Obviously, I think the year before, you'd come from UF3, hadn't you? I think you'd done the last race with MP or in Abu Dhabi, if I remember correctly. So you sort of had a taste, I suppose, of it. And then you obviously signed with Prema. How was that kind of shift from, you know, Carl in UF3 to, the you know, Prema, effectively?
Yeah, I think obviously 2017, we had a season together, didn't we, in F3. And that was probably a better year than I had in 2018. We all struggled quite a lot the year of my pink car. Obviously, I had Sasha and Ferdinand, obviously top drivers. But at the end, I finished 10th in the championship. We were pretty much struggling pretty much everywhere we went. Obviously, it was difficult to get the Prema seat. But, you know, I was pretty much really, really wanted it. And I told them I'm confident that I can do well and, you know, match whoever's in the car. So at the end, I got the seat. I was very happy. And at the end, it was a full different experience the year before. You know, like the year before, sometimes when I didn't feel quick, I would overdrive, make mistakes, do stuff like that. But in 2019, I knew that the car would be good. So all I had to do was just believe in myself, do a good lap, nail all the corners and, you know, do nothing special. Just use my references. And I think I qualified in the top four every qualifying apart from Budapest, where I was stuck in traffic and stuff.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, I remember that session. Yeah, that was unlucky.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that was a big turnaround that season. Obviously, I was in the title fight till the last race. And that season helped me, obviously, get my junior seat at Red Bull. So, you know, it was a big, big change.
I know what you mean, though, about, like, when you feel like you just know you've got a good car and comparing that to when you think you'd haven't. And you know what it's like. You're in the truck and you're analyzing everything out of the data and watching any onboard camera you can get, watching the TV sessions back, trying to think about it. And before you go into the session, you're almost thinking about, you know, data almost of like, you know, I need to brake here, my brake trace needs to look like that, I need to be on the throttle there, I need to use that gear, I need to delay the downchange, whatever.
Yeah.
But I've been there, probably not for a whole season, but I've had it. I mean, we had it even pace through the second half of last year, where I was just confident and you knew the car was quick, and it's so much more obviously relaxing, but you just delivered more often than not because of that.
Definitely. Yeah.
But obviously, I mean, it wasn't, it seems like every year Primus seems to put the car out for whoever's in the car.
I think in all categories, not only in F3, I think they're good everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think it was 2016 with GP, when it was still GP2, they entered with Gasly and Giovinazzi, and they walked, obviously wiped the floor with everyone. And then I honestly thought that when they changed 2018 to 2019 from UF3 to FIA3, that they can't do that again. Like, and they didn't really do that again. It wasn't as obvious, but it's just whatever the tire, whatever the chassis, engine, whatever, it's just some philosophy or something that they have. Also, I guess it seems like quite a family atmosphere from the outside.
Yeah, very good. I think, it's pretty much like family when I was there for a year. And like, I still feel like I am part of that Prema family. Very good team. I love Italy. Obviously, the food is amazing. It was hard for me not to put on weight when I was there.
Yeah.
But, like you said, a very, very family team. So it was a very good season.
Yeah. And like you touched on earlier, that season gave you the chance to join Red Bull. How did that, like, a conversation, you went to them or they came to you?
No, actually, it was obviously I was looking to go to Colin in 2020. Yeah. And obviously Yuki was having talks with Colin as well. And Trevor told me that Helmut is interested in having a conversation and a chat with us. So I'd actually met him straight after qualifying at Sochi in the last round. And we had a little chat, and he seemed interested. And I said, yeah, I'm really confident. If you give me the seat that I can deliver, and I'll obviously do my best. And he was more than happy to obviously take me on board. But a month later, I did my knee completely. So I was out from Macau. I was not sure if I'd recover in time. Oh,
yeah. No, I've just completely forgotten now, because Vesti filled your seat, didn't he?
Yeah, Vesti took my seat. And so it was like a four-month delay till I actually was fully fit and recovered. And then we had signed the deal with Red Bull just before preseason testing started.
How did you do your knee?
Yeah. What did you do to it?
I was playing football back at home in Mumbai, and I didn't play the whole year pretty much because I didn't want to have any risk in the season. But I was like, season's done. There's a month now till Macau. So I was playing football and it was like wet mud. My studs got stuck in. I got tackled, and I did two ligaments, ACL, MCL, and I did partially this as well.
Proper job then.
Yeah, full on. Full job.
You should be a motorbike racer.
Yeah, you'd be on after a week.
Yeah.
You guys are nuts though. Was it your left leg as well?
No, right leg. Luckily my right leg. Yeah
I was going to say, if it was left leg, that would be a bit worse, I think.
I was back in a con 3 months, I think, in January. Just test it out.
Yeah, those footballers need to just get their act together a bit, I think. Taking 9 months or whatever it is.
No, I think for football or something, it's like I was still not walking right, but I could drive because the throttle pedal is easy.
Mm. Yeah.
If it was brake pedal, then it was no chance.
Yeah. Jesus Christ. I mean, I don't know many people that have done their ACL in racing. That's pretty out there. I think you're on your own with that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I want to ask sort of how involved, let's say, is Helmut sort of through your season or your weekends or whatever? Is he always applying pressure? Do you take it as positive pressure?
Yeah, I think he's very good. Obviously, he, like everyone knows, his reputation, he's pretty much straightforward to us. If you have a bad week, and he's calling you up. If you have a very good weekend, he's also going to call you up. If you have a so-so weekend, then there's nothing. So, you know that when things are not going well and you see the call from Helmut, you got to pick up and, just accept it. I think he likes when you tell him like the truth more than anything. If you keep making excuses, he really doesn't like it at all. So, I think if you do make a mistake or mess up, the thing is just put your hand up and say, I fucked up. And, next time I'll try not to repeat it.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought that obviously Red Bull's quite, from the outside, I think it looks a bit harsh sometimes, but it's got to be, I would take it as quite positive pressure, because I think you're probably the same, that I don't think anyone can put more pressure on me than I already do myself.
Yeah.
Like my expectations already like where they want it to be, if not more. So all I kind of feel like I want is just the path or the opportunity. That same, yeah. And Red Bull, you know, more than most, I think, give you the opportunity if you do the job. If you don't do the job, yeah, you're out. But if you don't do the job without them, then you're also not getting there anyway.
Exactly. And also the thing is, which I really like, is they obviously sign you for a reason, because they believe that you're talented and good enough to go to F1. And then when you do join the program, they don't change you as a person, you know. You can pretty much, you know, you keep your own trainer, you keep everything that was working well. And they just, like you said, they just support you and they give you a pathway to Formula One if you do perform. So,
yeah.
You know, I've been after a difficult season last year for a lot of the season, you know, they showed a lot of faith to trust me again this year after a few good results at the end of last year. So, you know, this obviously Yuri and Liam are also at a very high level. So, you know, it's always going to be between the three of us, and probably there's only going to be one seat that opens up. So, you know, whoever obviously impresses and does well the rest of the year will probably have the biggest chance.
Have you sent a little message in about getting an FP1 or something?
Not really. Not really too rushed about it. I think it just depends on timing and results and how things are going more in my two season. I think if probably after Italy or Sochi, we should, after round six, before our big gap again, we should have an idea of what's going on and what's happening. And you know, like Yuki last year, he didn't do any FP1s, but they still gave him private test days at Imola to get ready after he made sure he delivered an F2. So that's my main focus. And, you know, if things do go well and I do get the chance, I'm sure that we will get a lot of days in an F1 car before.
Yeah, I suppose things like that or whatever happens next year, whether it's F1 or something, I suppose with it having, you having two races in November, I think. You have Abu Dhabi and Saudi Arabia, I think. Yeah, it's quite late, isn't it?
So we obviously have Silverstone 1 month from now, then a 2 month break again, and then Italy and Sochi pretty close to each other, and then another 2 month break, and then Jeddah and Saudi.
Mate, we'll have to go karting.
Yeah. We should all go karting. I actually texted Yuri the other day. I think we might go rental karting next week, but not like proper hiking.
Yeah. I mean, I went karting with Seb Morris about 2 months ago, just at PFI again. Brilliant. Loved it. Just
physical. Imagine.
It's hard. My hands.
Yeah, you can't lift the wheel.
No, I don't know what it was. It's the angle of it or something, like compared to a steer. I was trying to look at it, like, why is that hurting my hands? But there's something, the position of it was no OTK, so it was Tony Park. So I don't know if that's something with that, but I never remember struggling before.
No, but even me, when I drove with the bumps and stuff at Wilton, I couldn't let go of the wheel. I had to take cooldown laps because my fingers were hurting a lot.
Have you ever done KZ at Wilton?
Yeah, I did one day and I've never done it again.
Grim, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really painful.
So you drive the whole lap one-handed?
Yeah. You're just shifting up and down the whole time. Yeah.
It's the worst track. It's the worst kind of track for that, I think. Yeah, but we'll have to do that, I think, because we've been talking about trying to do some days anyway, because I've been out of a car for a while, so I want to keep it as active as I can. Yeah. And also, I did the last one. We were going to film it and stuff. So, which we'll see what we can do with that. Actually, obviously,
we could invite the whole F2 group. Because we know they're not doing anything.
We'll do like a Top Gear timesheet or something.
Yeah.
Also, we got England right now because he's stuck in Italy. So he's trying to come here, obviously do the isolation bit, and then chill out for a bit here.
Yeah. Who's that? Who's that? Sorry,
Marcus.
Yeah, we'll get Marcus there as well.
Yeah. An F2 star in our reasonably priced rental car.
Yeah, you saved that quite well. Then you were stuck there mid sentence, weren't you?
I was. I almost messed it up, but we didn't. We move.
Yeah,
we move.
So just like, I think we'll start wrapping up in a minute, but I just want to ask you just quickly before we start to sign off. Obviously, I can already probably know your answer, but what is the goal? Like, obviously, just thinking about F1 at the moment, winning F2, hopefully, and seeing what comes afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, my main target is to win the title, but in a very competitive field like this, if I finish in the top three, I think it'll be a successful season.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's it seems like quite often the top three in the last few years in F2 get a chance to go to F1.
Yeah, I think that is true. But obviously, if Liam and Yuri are top three, then it's not going to be like that. So obviously, the main priority for me is to win the title. And then, you know, I've done everything I can and the rest is not in my control.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's all you need to focus on, mate. Just your own job. Are you, I suppose, again, I already know the answer, but you no consideration to any other forms of motorsport? Yeah, like would you ever like to do Indy or
I think Indy is out because I promised my mom when I started the race I would never do Indy.
I'm the same. I did the same.
So unless I do only street courses, maybe it's a possibility, but ovals are out of the equation.
I don't know about you, but I don't really have the desire at the moment to want to do it. I don't know why.
Yeah, obviously for me right now, I'm just focusing on F1. But, you know, if it doesn't work out, obviously, I just want to be a professional racing driver. So, you know, anything I can drive with four wheels on it, I'll be happy to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I promised my mum I wouldn't do Indy or an oval or motorbikes. And we got one of those people here who does that.
I promised my mum I wouldn't do the TT or any road racing.
Still do bikes, mate.
Yeah, no, the thing, I make way too many mistakes to do something like road racing, that's for sure. But yeah, we'll wrap it up there, guys. Massive thanks to GM for coming on. It was really fun. Really good to hear from you, and as you said earlier, consistency is key this year, and look at Yuri last weekend. Turns around like that. So no, mate, I hope you have a really good rest of the year. If anybody wants to follow him, make sure you check him out on social medias. He's at GHAND98 on Instagram. And we'll be back, well, actually later today, in about half an hour, for the next recording.
Yeah, but they don't know that. It's weekly intervals.
Well, and we're not going to tell them who it is. So we're going to keep them guessing. But yeah, massive thanks to everyone for checking out the podcast. And leave a like, comment, leave a rating on Apple and Spotify, and get in the YouTube comments and let us know who you'd like to see on the podcast soon. But we'll catch you in the next one, guys. Cheers.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, mate.